Jacksonville has a public health crisis, a high rate of HIV infection. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, why a new PBS series is spotlighting Jacksonville and this city's struggles to combat HIV and AIDS. What are your thoughts and questions about HIV in the year 2019? Give us a call now at 549-2937 or tweet at Jessica Pub Radio. Then later, Beatlemania comes back to the First Coast. I'll tell you about a look back at the Beatles invasion in Florida happening tomorrow night in Ponte Vedra. But first this hour, it's a fresh look at the history of HIV and AIDS in America and the ongoing public health crisis with AIDS we have right here in Jacksonville. Retro Report is a new series from PBS that offers fresh perspectives on today's headlines by revealing their unknown and often surprising connections to the past. The eighth episode, airing tomorrow night, features Jacksonville. Let's take a listen.
The places where the epidemic is growing are in those communities where people of color typically have not had access to resources, where poverty sits.
Cindy Watson works with LGBTQ youth in Jacksonville, Florida, which has one of the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses in the country.
We have these pills, but if people can't get access to them, if their lives are not stable and in a place where they can continue to take them over time, they don't have the benefit of the medication and of living with a chronic illness, and they're also infectious.
While rates of HIV infection have fallen in many places, the crisis remains in full force in some parts of the country, as we just heard, including here on the First Coast. We begin this hour with a closer look. Joining us by phone, Meryl Agish is a reporter for the show Retro Report on PBS. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you for being here. And also with us here in studio this morning, Cindy Watson, who we heard in that clip, CEO of Jasmine here in Jacksonville. Her organization is featured in this week's show on HIV and AIDS. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Jessica.
Thank you for being here. And here's our question to our callers. What are your questions about the continued spread of HIV here in Florida? Do you have a personal experience you'd like to share? Call us now, 549-2937, or you can tweet at Jessica Pub Radio this morning. So, Meryl, I want to start with you. And why did you decide to include Jacksonville in this segment on AIDS for Retro Report?
Sure. I just want to say thank you for having me on today. So I was starting out in February of this year trying to figure out, okay, I had done some reporting, some interviewing in Indiana for the historical part of the piece, but I needed to build out the contemporary section. And I was speaking with Susan Reeve at Duke University, who is a researcher in HIV and AIDS across the South at Duke University. And she specifically recommended getting in touch with Cindy Watson in Jacksonville. And I was looking at a couple of different areas to go to. And when I got in touch with Cindy, you know, she was just so welcoming immediately and wanted to, you know, help us out by letting us film, you know, sort of the day in the life, 2 days in the life of Jasmine. And because of everything that's going on locally, in and out of the organization, you know, there was just so much to capture. And I only found out, you know, after coming back home during the State of the Union that there was a big plan that was going to be rolled out by the Trump administration to combat HIV in these specific hotspots across the country. And Duval County is one of them. It just ended up being this coincidence that it worked out in that way. But because of everything that was going on locally in Jacksonville, I felt like it was the right type of place to go to really get a sense of, you know, what is it like to be a young person in the middle of all this? And Jasmine was the perfect place to capture that.
That's right. And we'll hear more about that in just a moment. But Meryl, I want to start asking you, though, about the historical aspect of this episode. And you mentioned you were working in, what was it, Indiana?
Indiana, yes.
And what were you focusing on there?
Sure. So the piece traces out some of these themes that have been present in the HIV/AIDS epidemic from the very beginning. And I was in Indiana in particular because of Ryan White's story. So Ryan White, as I'm sure many people know, was a young hemophiliac who was diagnosed in 1984. And he was one of the first juvenile AIDS cases. And because he was just this very charismatic young person and also was, I think, a different type of figure than we were associating with the crisis at that point, he, captured the nation's attention in a way that was unlike any other person at that time. I mean, we had Rock Hudson, we had a number of celebrities who were going public with their status, but Ryan had a different appeal, I think, to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I was in Indiana to interview some of his old friends, some parents in the community, one of the attorneys who was involved in the case because Ryan was being shut out from his local middle school at that time. So I was interviewing, a number of those people to be able to tell the story. What was it like being in the middle of this media frenzy in this very early stage of the AIDS crisis in this country when, so little was known, and, that was the starting point for the piece. Mm-hmm. So we go through, and I have to just let everybody know, this is a short segment. It's only about 11, 12 minutes long. So there's so much that cannot be said about this very, very huge, very complicated topic. But this was one way to get into the story, to look at some of these themes that I think are still very present today with how we, as a country, decide to, pay attention to some things, really rally behind certain causes. And you see over time that some of the energy has changed in the way that the public, views the current HIV epidemic, because it still is a very, mm-hmm. real part of our lives. But there's a different energy around it, I think, and the piece investigates some of those questions.
So you went from Indiana to Jacksonville. And Cindy, you are here on the ground working every day in Jacksonville on this issue. Why are the rates so high here?
Well, I just want to start by saying hi to Meryl. And, Jasmine started our 25th anniversary year this year. And so we were looking back and also looking forward. And it was just an interesting experience to connect with Meryl and look back at the Ryan White history. As well as looking at what's happening today and forward. Jacksonville has an epidemic that's of great concern. We've been on the top 10 lists of cities with the highest incidence of new infections for several years. And so that's why we're one of the top 50 cities that are considered hotspots under the federal government's in the epidemic initiative. I talk about this in the clip. We, at this point, we have the medical resources to really end this epidemic, to really stop HIV, or at least stop AIDS. What we don't have yet is enough resources and community will to put all of that into action. And one of the things that's important in Jacksonville is stigma. This community, Northeast Florida and Jacksonville, there's still a great deal of stigma that people who have HIV experience in their families, in their faith communities, in their schools, just about anywhere they go. And that stigma keeps people from accessing testing, from accessing treatment, from being able to follow through. It's a very powerful thing, stigma. When you link it in our situation with homophobia and transphobia, so concerns about being LGBT, being gay or bisexual or transgender, that becomes a really complicated barrier to people being able to get treatment.
How much of the issue is due to stigma, do you think, and is due to lack of resources?
When you look at Florida, the state of Florida has one of the largest epidemics in the country. And if you look at the cities in South Florida, which are so much bigger than us, they have a much higher number of people with HIV in the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm area. So a lot more people have HIV than in Jacksonville. But the rate, based on population, mm-hmm. is what makes us have concerns, because the numbers of people here may not be as high as South Florida, but in terms of the percentage of the population, it's still very significant. But when you look at how the dollars come into the state, the federal dollars, the dollars flow to large numbers. And so Jacksonville is at the bottom of the list in terms of funding. We have to sometimes compete with those larger cities in South Florida for resources. So I would say, the resources are distributed proportionally according to the numbers. And that, because we're in Florida, that puts us at the bottom of the list.
Who is most at risk for contracting HIV in Jacksonville?
So if you look at the epidemiological data in Florida and in Jacksonville, we know that people of color, particularly African-American people, are at the greatest risk. One of the stats that I know is that Jacksonville is number two in the country for the rate of new infections among African-American men ages 13 and up. And then we also know that when we look at mode of transmission, we know that men who have sex with men are at a very high risk for HIV. And then the other thing we know is that young people are impacted. And this is true across the country. Young men of color who are gay, bisexual, or young transgender women are some of the are the population that carry one of the largest burdens of the epidemic. So that's one of the reasons why Jasmine's work is so important in this city, because that's who we work with. We provide a community space, a safe place, and a lot of really intensive kind of support services for young people who are LGBTQ, who are gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning, queer, and who are the very population often that are carrying the burden for this epidemic.
Are you helping prevent them from ever being infected with HIV?
That's a great question. You know, I've been working at Jasmine for as long as it's been here, and I came to Jasmine very specifically because I was concerned about the HIV epidemic back in the early 90s.
I'm sorry, can you say the question again?
How are you helping prevent?
Okay, prevention. So what we want to do is help those young people who are very high risk get access, not just to what we think of as behavioral interventions and condoms, which are an important prevention strategy, but also to get access to the biomedical interventions, namely PrEP. Mm-hmm. And PrEP is a pill that is a pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it's a prevention pill that people can take if they're very high risk for HIV. In our setting at the Jasmine campus, we have a clinic with the health department, and we provide access to PrEP for those young people who are very high risk. That's a very strategic attempt to help them not contract HIV. And at the same time, we work with young people who do have HIV to help them link to medical care, because we know once they have medical care, once they have the medications and are able to stay on them, their health is much better, but they also are not infectious. And so that's a sort of a two-strategy approach that we're very much engaged with. It's completely aligned with the federal policies and the priorities in the End the Epidemic initiative. The challenge is that there are not enough resources for all of that, you know, and there are barriers. There are barriers in the local healthcare system for young people, especially, and for people that have unstable lives. And so it really takes it takes resources and it takes intention to really address those.
We talked about the stigma. We heard about the stigma being a huge factor to this day, according to you, Cindy. Meryl, I wanted to ask you about that in your research for this segment. How, if at all, have you seen the stigma associated with this disease changing over the years?
Well, I think, like Cindy says, it's certainly still there. It was there from the very beginning, and you could see that in the news coverage in particular. The way that many of our pieces work, we draw so heavily from the evening news, from different archival sources, and you can see as soon as AIDS started being covered in the nightly news, there was a way that the story was framed. This tended to be something associated with gay people, with injection drug users, with these kind of isolated groups who were not like the mainstream American culture. And because of that, there was this distancing initially of AIDS being perceived as somebody else's problem. And it was with stories like Ryan White's that it became clear, no, this can affect anybody, and it will affect anybody, and it does affect anybody. So you could see it in the news coverage, how the story started to change as the epidemic grew. More people, unfortunately, were getting infected and dying, in great numbers. And I think when the tide started to shift a bit, and then you could see the cultural response changing, the political response changing on the federal level, then there was a little bit of a different attitude toward it. But I think the stigma in Ryan White's story too, that was ever present in everything that came up in his story, that he was infected through a blood transfusion, and pretty soon after, the local school board prevented him from going back to school. He was a middle school kid. He was 13 years old, 14 years old, and all he wanted to do, he said, at the time, was to just live his life. He didn't want to be treated any differently than anybody else, but because there was still so little known about, how other people may become infected, there was this great fear and panic on the local level. And even at that point, even with federal, the health authorities saying, if this child is in school under normal circumstances, there's really very little risk that anything would happen. But you could see in the parental reactions back then, too, they said, we don't know. We don't know anything about this. We don't know what may happen to our children.
Right.
And there was this great fear. And it got to a point where, there were accommodations being made. He had a call-in system at the time to try to participate in school. And, it's kind of funny, some of those segments, because you can see it's not working. He really he's this little kid who just wants to be in school. But, I mean, not a little kid, he was a teenager, but he wants to be in school, and he's not able to. And then the way that his story tracked with him fighting, these legal battles to get back to school, eventually he did make it. But the stigma was so great in his town that he and his family eventually left after he won that battle, because it just wasn't really possible for him to live, an ordinary life in that town anymore. So from the very beginning, you can see these different themes that emerge either, on the side of isolating some of the communities that were being most affected at that time, and, still are in many cases, or in a story like Ryan's, where it plays out in this very, you could see it, how it was affecting this teenager and his family.
Cindy, you work with teenagers, your organization works with teenagers. Today, somebody who's infected with HIV, are they going through those same things that Ryan White went through, or are they able to be more normal teens?
The thing that young people today continue to experience is that fear of people knowing that they have HIV, or that they're getting a test, or that they might be at risk for some reason. We see lots of young people who are afraid to tell their families. They don't want their peers to know. And it's because of that fear of the same thing Ryan White experienced, that I'll be rejected. Maybe I won't be kicked out of school, but I'll be targeted. People will talk about me. I'll be rejected. They'll call me names. No one will want to be my friend. My parents will kick me out. That's a very real concern for some young people. And so that's why we know that stigma is very much alive. inside the minds of all those young people, but that means that it's in the culture, you know, because it didn't just, it didn't come from nowhere. You know, it came from messages that young people have been getting for a long time. One of the things we know about stigma is that it has to come out of the closet, that to really fight it, you have to bring it out and you have to open up and allow people to see that it's not a terrible thing. You know, that people with HIV are just like everybody else. But that's a lot to put on a teenager, right? That's a pretty heavy burden to say, okay, well, you've got to come out and be openly, open about your HIV status.
Even for adults, I'm sure that's difficult.
That's very difficult. And so that's why it's important for folks like, for organizations like Jasmine to be very open and out and for people to stand with. And also, I mean, we have programs to help young people think about, how do I disclose this? Who do I disclose it to? And how do I talk about it in ways that will feel right for me and feel empowering for me? And at the same time, share the information. So we spend a lot of time with young people thinking through those things. And consequently, we have a group of young people who are very out, who are very open. Mm. But it's because they've been through a process and have had a lot of support in figuring that out. And they know that as they speak out, they have a support network behind them. That's what Jasmine offers. So I think in the segment, we may hear from some of those young people. Mm. Who actually are able to talk about it. And that's the key to addressing stigma.
California recently passed a law that allows pharmacists to give out PrEP to people who come in to a pharmacy. And that law is not in Florida, but are people able to do that with the health department?
So there are initiatives, and that is aligned with the end of the epidemic as well, to make PrEP available same day that it's requested. Just like to make HIV medication same day as when you discover your diagnosis. Test and treat is a really important initiative. And what that does is it helps people right away begin on the journey of prevention or taking care of themselves. We support that, and we work really hard with young people to access those services. It's not in a pharmacy today, but there are some clinics that are working toward that, that quick response. It goes against a lot of kind of practices, you know, that have been in place for a long time in the healthcare system, where you do a lot of labs and you kind of know what people, you know, what's going on before you prescribe medication. And then it also goes against the payment system, because usually you don't get meds until all of the financial pieces are worked out. And when you're talking about young people, they don't often have access to insurance. So it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So it does require someone like Jasmine, an advocate from Jasmine, to be with a young person to help get through all of those barriers to make it happen. We look for a day, and I don't think it's too far away, when young people can get immediate treatment or immediate access to PrEP. There are situations now where immediate treatment is available for HIV positive young people. But we want to take that to scale, right? We want to make it as easy as in California, where you just go to the corner pharmacy and you're able to access it. Mm-hmm. We're not quite there yet.
Well, speaking of resources to make prevention available, I want to ask you, Cindy, a recent investigation by The Guardian found that the state of Florida under former Governor Rick Scott returned about $54 million in HIV prevention money to the federal government instead of spending it. A former health department official said she placed the blame for new infections squarely with Scott himself. And at the same time, the money was going unspent from 2015 to 2017. The number of new infections rose. Did you see the effects of that money not being available here in Northeast Florida?
I saw the article. It's hard to say what would have happened if more dollars had been in place at that time. But I do know we don't have enough resources yet. And I do know that the political will is not clearly aligned with people on the ground like us who see the great need to move forward and to take these things to scale. I do think things are shifting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in my perspective, it's always a downright shame when we turn away dollars that could really impact real people's lives.
Well, speaking of things shifting, we did see an announcement this month that 7 Florida counties are being targeted with new federal dollars for prevention. Can you speak about that?
So that's the End the Epidemic initiative that the federal government's responding to. I think Merrill mentioned that as well. So we work very closely with the Duval County Health Department, and I think they will be one of the conduits for some of those dollars. And then I think the city of Jacksonville, through their Ryan White funded HIV prevention plan or HIV planning body, will also be a conduit. And we're also, I mean, Jasmine has staff who sit on that planning body as well. So we're aware of that. We haven't seen any of those dollars yet. And the systems and mechanisms aren't quite in place to push those through, but I think of that as a positive next step because if we have enough resources, from my perspective, to make sure people have the kinds of human support, the advocacy and the navigation and the actual intensive support, we can impact this epidemic and we can see the young people now becoming the first AIDS-free generation in our lifetime. HIV may be around, but we will stop this the conversion to AIDS because we will be able to stop it, slow it down, and really begin to impact prevention.
You mentioned that when you first became involved with Jasmine, a big impetus was trying to stop HIV from spreading. From then until now, from the 90s until today, what do you see as the biggest changes in this area?
Well, one of the things in the 90s, as Merrill mentioned, a lot of people were dying because we did not have medications and we did not have the technology hadn't advanced enough. Today, having HIV is really like having a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all the resources that we need to stop this virus. The stigma persists. I mean, I think we are whittling away at it. We've definitely come a long way, but we haven't finished this job yet. You know, 25 years is a long time to be doing this work and we're not done yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep pushing forward to get to that AIDS-free generation.
What is your biggest wish for what can be done in this area that's not being done today?
I would love to see, access to PrEP for young people readily available. We have PrEP in our clinic. We offer PrEP through our clinic with the health department, but we're capped at 20 people.
Mm.
That's a really small number. I would really love to see that go to scale and be as easy as possible. I think, you know, there continue to be barriers in the system for really helping people with HIV get access to all the resources they need. So that's another big wish for me. And then the ability to really address stigma in many more ways.
Do you have a wait list? How does that 20-person cap work?
So we're constantly providing HIV testing for young people and determining if they're actually eligible or appropriate for PrEP.
Mm.
And then trying to connect. So if we can't serve them, we are trying to connect them with other clinics, but they're barriers. And we run a youth-friendly clinic. So young people walk in, it's a youth-friendly space. It's an easy, it's really different from going to a hospital or a doctor's office. We try not to have a wait list, but we try to help them find other ways.
Mm. That's Cindy Watson, CEO of Jasmine. Thank you very much for being here. And Meryl Agish, reporter for the show Retro Report on PBS. Thank you, Meryl.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tune in to Retro Report on PBS. New episodes air Monday and Tuesday nights on WJCT's main channel 7.1. Tomorrow night's episode features the Jacksonville efforts to deal with HIV. That's tomorrow night at 9 on WJCT-TV. And the episodes are also streaming at pbs.org. Up next, a look back to the Beatles' first tour in Florida. We'll be right back.
WJCT's podcast Oddball is a Jacksonville story about a UFO investigation, a mansion in the woods, and how one shiny object silenced a family.
Jerry just wanted to know what it was.
She would have a gut instinct and she would pursue it.
After a while, it's just too much publicity. She just not want to talk about it anymore.
Can we put the mystery of the strange metal ball to rest? Check it out at oddballpodcast.com.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and for Melissa Ross, this is First Coast Connect. This week, it's a special presentation in Pontevedra taking music lovers back to the days of the British invasion. It's a look back at the time the Fab Four, yes, the Beatles, first came to Florida. Here with more is author and historian Scott A. Grant. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Jessica. It's great to be here. And it's very exciting to be talking about the Beatles.
I always love talking about the Beatles. So Beatles fans are sure to love this presentation. Scott, when is this happening?
This will be tomorrow night at the Cultural Center in Pontevedra Beach, Florida at 5:30. I think I actually go on at 6, but the event begins at 5:30.
Okay. So what are people going to learn if they come on out?
Well, the big thing is that the Beatles come to Florida twice, and only twice. And both of those appearances are in 1964. And the first trip takes them to Miami. They're young. They're innocent. They meet Muhammad Ali, although he's still called Cassius Clay at that time. And they clown around with him. And they're on the Ed Sullivan Show for the second time and the final live appearance. And then the second trip brings them to Jacksonville, to the Gator Bowl, right across the street.
Yes.
And that trip is a little more fraught with peril. The Beatles are a little more jaded at this time. There's some issues with the Gator Bowl being segregated. Mm. The Beatles don't want to come. At the last minute, the city relents. The concert goes on, but not until a hurricane hits.
So much drama in one story.
It's a fascinating day. September 11th, 1964, you have this hurricane. We're post-hurricane news, and that's a big news item. And President Johnson, LBJ, shows up in the morning. And he goes to Atlantic Beach and he gets his picture taken. And then in the afternoon, the Beatles, who've been diverted to Key West and have spent 2 days getting drunk in Key West, show up in Jacksonville and they perform this concert. And the winds are howling. They have to nail Ringo Starr's drum kit to the stage.
Wow.
To keep it from blowing away. And they do this 35-minute performance. They played 12 songs. They lead off with Rollover Beethoven, which we think might be the only time they let off a concert with Rollover Beethoven, which is a Chuck Berry song, and maybe sort of a comment about some of the earlier problems with the Gator Bowl. And then they leave. And so they spend 8 days in Miami, and there's a lot of stuff about Miami in the presentation, and then they come here, and there's also a fair amount about the trip to Jacksonville.
How did Florida change the Beatles?
Well, you know, when they show up here in Miami, they're very innocent. There's a picture in Life magazine of John Lennon doing a cannonball in a pool in South Beach. They go out on Bernie Castro's fishing boat. Now, Bernie Castro invented the Castro convertible bed. I think some people in the audience may remember those. And they go fishing. They go on dates. In fact, Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr go on a double date to a drive-in movie theater to see an Elvis Presley film with two girls from Miami in a 1963 Lincoln Continental. And you think about the Beatles later, it just seems improbable, right? You know, just two local girls. They met on the beach. They met them on the beach. And, of course, the whole Muhammad Ali experience is a fantastic story. There's all these pictures, which we will show tomorrow. Muhammad Ali knocking out all four Beatles with a single punch, carrying a Ringo Starr around the Fifth Street Gym in Miami. Like he's a baby. Ali's there because he's getting ready to fight Sonny Liston. And the Beatles don't even want to meet him. Ali's 22. I think the Beatles are 21, 22, 23. They both know who they are, but nobody knows who those five guys are going to become.
Right.
You know, arguably the five most iconic figures of the second half of the 20th century, all in a gym in downtown Miami, as kids playing around. But it's clear that by the end of the concert tour, and the Gator Bowl is one of the 26 shows in 33 days that they do, you know, on this tour, that the Beatles are a bit jaded. You know, it's no longer doing cannonballs in somebody's pool, water skiing off the coast of Miami. They're jaded, and I think jaded with America and jaded a little bit with Florida. And Jacksonville's part of that. And we're from Jacksonville. We want Jacksonville to be great. And this was a great event in Jacksonville history. I mean, the Beatles didn't go that many places. This was the only real concert that they ever played in the state of Florida. It was right here.
Yeah. What happened that day when they played here?
Well, they show up in the afternoon. Some stories say that the plane had to circle for a while until Johnson had left. I'm not sure that that's true, but Johnson has left by the time they get here. So they get here in the early afternoon. The concert starts that evening. They go to the George Washington Hotel. They don't check in. And they don't check in because while they have integrated the Gator Bowl, the George Washington Hotel is still segregated at that point, and there are no rooms for the African-American opening acts. It includes the Exciters and Frogman Henry, who's still alive and performs in New Orleans. So they don't check in. They do a press conference in the ballroom, and there's a bunch of, you know, various press there to interview them, including Gene Harris from Tampa, who was a TV personality at that point. And she asks them each whether they're married. And she seems particularly interested in learning that information. And then they get into a 1963 Ford, a little Ford, and they drive to the Gator Bowl. And they all sit in the back seat. That's a great picture, too. Mm-hmm. You know, just imagine all four Beatles stuffed in the back seat of a small Ford. And they drive to the Gator Bowl and they do the show. One of the stories that's always interests me is that because there were so many other things going on in Jacksonville that day, the Times Union sends Billy Bussard. And Billy's, you know Billy. Billy's 19 years old at that time. And they send her and she's wandering around the George Washington Hotel looking for somebody to interview. And she gets onto an elevator and goes into the elevator with her head down, looks up, and realizes she's on an elevator with all four Beatles.
Oh, wow.
which has got to be one of the great opportunities of all time. But she's so starstruck that she presses the next button, next floor button, and gets off. And it's only later.
No conversation
at all. Later, she realizes her mistake, and she goes to the manager of the tour, and he gets her on in the car that takes the Beatles to the airport and actually gets her onto the Beatles airplane.
Wow.
And she interviews them there and writes a story about it for the Times Union the next day.
Was the controversy over the Gator Bowl, was that a big deal at the time?
It was a huge deal to the Beatles and I think to the people in the city. I mean, Jacksonville's always had a segment of this population that's pretty liberal and a segment that's pretty conservative. And those two segments fight with each other continuously throughout this history of this city. And so you had a lot of people upset that the Beatles were complaining about segregation at all. A lot of the older folks were not that happy. Younger folks, on the other hand, really wanted the Beatles to come here. It was a big deal. They sold 30 to 35,000 tickets. Now, most of the people can't, or I shouldn't say most, a lot of the people can't make it because of the hurricane. Only about 20, 23,000 show up.
Oh, wow.
Tickets were $5 and $4. Huh. So you could get the good seats down on the floor for $5. But in any event, it was a big controversy. John Lennon early on says that he doesn't want to come to perform at a segregated location, that he would sooner give up his appearance money. And 1 week before the show, the Beatles are in Toronto. They issue a statement that they will not come unless white and colored people are allowed to sit together.
Mm. Was there a lasting legacy of that decision?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, the interesting thing is that the Civil Rights Act had been passed and signed into law on July 2nd by President Johnson. So segregation was illegal at this point. And we're, you know, the Gator Bowl is still segregated. Presumably after that event, I don't think that there were a lot more segregated events at the Gator Bowl. Maybe none. But I've never actually looked into it. I don't know.
So for people who want to come out to see this talk tomorrow, tell us about how we can come.
Okay. It's at the Cultural Center in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, which is at 50 Executive Way. Doors open at 5:30. I think the announcement says 5:30 to 7:30. I'll probably talk from 6 to 6:30, give or take, maybe 6:45. Probably have some time for questions. I do a lot of historical presentations here in Jacksonville. I imagine people out there listening, some of them heard me, so they know the style. There'll be a movie running in the background, and I'll talk about kind of these events. And it will be a two-part event. You know, we'll talk about Miami. The Miami stuff's pretty fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And then we'll talk about Jacksonville as well. And I know people here really love hearing the Jacksonville part.
That's right. And very quickly, before we have to go, you recently wrote a book.
I did. It's entitled The Merchant of Death is Dead. And what it is, I've written hundreds of newspaper columns for several different newspapers, as well as a contributor to places like Folio Magazine. And it's some of the best articles I've written, including the title article, The Merchant of Death is Dead, which is about Alfred Nobel.
Okay. History, pop culture, all of that.
I like that stuff. Yeah. I sometimes call myself a pop historian. But yes, I like pop culture.
All right. That's pop historian. That's pop historian Scott Grant. You can see him tomorrow night at the Ponte Vedra Cultural Center. In a moment, Culpepper with sports news and notes from the weekend. That's up next.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Children living in poverty is now a major policy issue for some presidential candidates. We speak with an expert about the state of poverty in our country.
If you think about a family or a household budget, healthcare is one of the high costs. Childcare is another high cost. And so thinking about how does a family that's struggling make those choices?
Next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT. When you're scrolling past all those ads on social media, are you thinking you're being scammed? Because you might be.
Social media channels and online platforms don't screen the ads, and they don't screen the sellers that are there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Where there is money on social media, there will be scams. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Since 1935, the Bach Festival of Winter Park has been presenting concerts on the campus of Rollins College. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the history of the Bach Festival as they begin their 85th season. We'll visit Spook Hill and remember the TV show I Dream of Jeannie. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
General Motors and the United Auto Workers signed a labor contract back in 1950 known as the Treaty of Detroit. It helped America's middle class grow significantly. What does their latest deal tell us about the future of the American workforce? Preparing our labor market for new tech, more automation, and global trade, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. Finally this hour, the Jaguars take care of business and now head to London with a chance to move into playoff contention. Cole Pepper is here now. Cole, now let's assume, just hypothetically, that you're talking to somebody who doesn't know the first thing about sports,
okay,
and that person works with a bunch of Jags fans. Okay, totally theoretical, of
this
course.
Is just as a sort of a mental exercise.
Sure, right.
Here.
Completely theoretical. How would you help this person know everything they need to know when they join in that conversation with their coworkers in like 10 minutes?
Okay, I would tell that person, whoever he or she might be, Jessica,
yes,
that sort of the three big points you can make are, boy, this team is really hanging together well. With after everything they've gone through this year, they've really overcome a lot. That's point one. Point two, oh, how about Minshew? That's all you have to say. Minshew. And number three, I love it when they get sacks. So if you have those three things at your disposal, you can start the conversation, let everybody else go at it, and then just nod. And then at the end of the conversation, go Jags, and just exit stage left. That would be the best way to do it, particularly after that yesterday's performance for the Jaguars. 29-15, they beat the Jets. They should have beaten the Jets. The Jets have one win. The Jets are terrible. Their offensive line's a mess. Their quarterback last week admitted to seeing ghosts, which was maybe apropos leading into Halloween this week. The Jaguars' defensive line took care of business. Eight sacks, including two more from rookie defensive end Josh Allen, who was on pace for the second-best rookie sack season since the league started to keep that total in 1982. The record is 14.5 by Javon Kurse, the former Florida Gator. He is on pace for 14, and I actually think he probably deserves to be ahead of that. He's had a couple of sacks taken back by penalties that happened somewhere else. That being said, Gardner Minshew's three touchdown passes certainly helped the Jaguars' cause. Leonard Fournette accounted for 136 yards. And the Jaguars are now 4-4 as they get set to head to London this week to face the Houston Texans. I don't think this game against the Jets is going to be one that's going to be remembered for very long. It was a game the Jaguars should have won, and they did. This was probably a better non-loss than it was a win, if you follow me. If they lost, things could have gotten dicey, but they didn't. And I will tell you that this team just sort of feels different than in some past years, and particularly last year's team. They aren't as much about themselves. I think that will pay dividends for the Jags as the second half rolls on. They don't have to beat the Texans to stay in the playoff race, but their next three games are all against division opponents, Houston, and then road games at Indy and Tennessee after the bye week. And I think the Jaguars are going to need to go 2-1 in that span to have a real shot at winning the division. It may only take 9 or 10 wins to get into the playoffs, so the Jaguars will have to have a winning record in the second half to get there. That's a far cry from where they were last year this time. What a difference a year makes.
How about that Minshew?
Yeah, exactly, Jessica. Boy, you nailed it. Woo! You know, I'm just telling you, it is.
Thanks, Cole. Well, It's also Florida Georgia Week already?
It is. I'm going to call it Georgia Florida Week in keeping with my tradition since the Bulldogs won last year. So whoever wins this year will get the high honor of having their name first when I talk about it for the next 364 days. This is a huge one in the history of this rivalry. Just the third time this century that the two teams will meet as top 10 teams. And the winner will likely win the SEC East. Both teams come in with just one loss each. It has been a pretty balanced last decade in this series, although Georgia has won the last two, including last year, winning a battle of top 10 teams 36-17. The game will remain in Jacksonville for the foreseeable future. This past week, the mayor announced that a new deal had locked up the game until 2023 with 2 years of an option, so 2025, if the option's picked up, which you would expect would probably happen. For both teams, this game is a make-or-break kind of game. The Bulldogs came into the season thinking they could contend for a national championship. If they lose this game, they cannot. The Gators were hoping to make a charge and knock Georgia off of the top of the SEC East. If they lose this game, they cannot do that. So the goals are certainly on the line for the Gators and the Bulldogs this year. All right, the other thing I want to talk about is Florida State. Finally got a win over North Carolina, or for the first time since beating North Carolina State. They beat Syracuse 35-17. Big day from Cam Akers. Four touchdowns. Noles are back to the 500 mark. They'll play Miami this week. Neither team is having the kind of season they had hoped for, but still a big rivalry game. And two other notes from the world of sports. One is Tiger Woods winning on the PGA Tour's first ever tournament held in Japan. He won the Zozo Championship. I mean, we've all grown up wanting to win the Zozo Championship, but it was significant for Tiger because it was his 82nd career win. That ties Sam Snead's career record on the PGA Tour. The record Tiger really wants, though, is the all-time majors list that is headed up by Jack Nicklaus. He still has some work to do as far as that is concerned. And the World Series continues amid all of this.
Right.
And the Houston Astros, who lost the first two games at home, came back and won the next three in Washington against the Nationals. The series now shifts back to Houston tomorrow for Game 6. The Astros can clinch it. What a pitching matchup. All-Stars Justin Verlander and Steven Strasburg will be on the mound for those two teams as they go at it in the Fall Classic.
That's Cole Pepper with everything you need to know from the world of sports this weekend. Thanks, Cole.
How about Minshew?
How about that Minshew? That's our program. Thank you to all of our guests this morning. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Brady Corum is on the board. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. Melissa Ross will be back tomorrow with a look at why mentoring is so important.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.